16. What is the main topic of this lecture?17. According to the professor, what two limitations were noted in Daguerre's process for developing and fixing latent images? 18. Listen again to part of the lecture, then answer the question.
At first, he couldn't figure out why. But eventually, he concluded that this must have occurred as a result of mercury vapor from a broken thermometer that was also in the enclosed in the cupboard. Supposedly, from this fortunate accident, he was able to invent a process for developing latent images on exposed plates.
Why does the professor say this?
Supposedly, from this fortunate accident, he was able to invent a process for developing latent images on exposed plates.
19. What substance was first used to fix the images? 20. What can we assume about photographers in the 1800s? 5. Authority. Now get ready to listen to a lecture and take notes about it. Listen to part of a lecture in an anthropology class.
The concepts of power and authority are related, but they're not the same. Power is the ability to exercise influence and control over others. And this can be observed on every level of society, from, well, the relationships within a family to the relationships among nations. Power is usually structured by customs and social institutions or laws, and tends to be exerted by persuasive arguments or coercion or even brute force. In general, groups with the greatest resources tend to have the advantage in power struggles. So, is power always legitimate? Is it viewed by members of society as justified? Well, no. Power can be realized by individuals or groups even when it involves the resistance of others, as long as they're in a position to impose their will. But what about power that is accepted by members of society as right and just? That is, legitimate power. Now we're talking about authority. And that is what I want to focus on today. Okay, when individuals or institutions possess authority, they have a recognized and established right to determine policies with the acceptance of those over whom they exercise control. Max Weber, the German classical sociologist, proposed three types of authority in society: traditional, charismatic, and rational or legal authority. In all three types, he acknowledged the right of those in positions of power to lead with the consent of the governed. So, how did Weber differentiate among the three types of authority? Well, he divided them according to how the right to lead and the duty to follow are interpreted. In traditional authority, power resides in customs and conventions that provide certain people or groups with legitimate power in their societies. Often, their origin is found in sacred traditions. The example that most often comes to mind is a monarchy in which kings or queens rule by birthright, not because of any particular quality of leadership or political election just because they have a claim to authority based on traditional acceptance of their position and, in some cases, their unique relationship with and responsibility in religious practices. The royal families in Europe or the emperors in Asia come to mind as examples of traditional authority. Okay, this contrasts sharply with charismatic authority, which is derived because of personal attributes that inspire admiration, loyalty, and even devotion. Leaders who exercise this type of authority may be the founders of religious movements or political parties, but it's not their traditional right to lead. What's important here is that their followers are mobilized more by the force of the leader's personality than by the tradition or the law. So, when we think of charismatic leaders in the United States, perhaps John Kennedy would be an example because he was able to project a youthful and energetic image that people were proud to identify with. Or, if you prefer Republicans, you may argue that Ronald Reagan was able to exercise authority by virtue of his charismatic appeal. In any case, going back to Weber, to qualify for charismatic authority, a leader must be able to enlist others in the service of a cause that transforms the social structure in some way. Which leaves us with legal rational authority, or power that is legitimized by rules, laws, and procedures. In such a system, leaders gain authority not by traditional birthrights or by charismatic appeal, but rather because they're elected or appointed in accordance with the law, and power is delegated to layers of officials who owe their allegiance to the principles that are agreed upon rationally and because they accept the ideal that the law is supreme. In a legal, rational society, people accept the legitimacy of authority as a government of laws, not of leaders. So, an example of this type of authority might be a president like Richard Nixon, who was threatened with impeachment because he was perceived as not governing within the law. Some sociologists have postulated that the three types of authority represent stages of evolution in society, that pre-industrial societies tend to respect traditional authority, but as societies move into an industrial age, the importance of tradition wanes in favor of charismatic authority, with a natural rise of charismatic leaders. Then, as the modern era evolves, the rational legal authority, embodied by rules and regulations, replaces the loyalty to leaders in favor of a respect for law. Of course, other sociologists argue that in practice, authority may be represented by a combination of several of these ideal types at any one time.
21. What is the main purpose of this lecture? According to the professor, what two factors are associated with charismatic authority? 23. Listen again to part of the lecture, then answer the question.
But what about power that is accepted by members of society as right and just? That is, legitimate power. Well, now we're talking about authority, and that is what I want to focus on today.
Why does the professor say this?
But what about power that is accepted by members of society as right and just? That is, legitimate power.
In an evolutionary model, how is rational legal authority viewed? 25. What does the professor imply about the three types of authority? Independent Listening 6. Mineral Exploitation. Now get ready to listen to a lecture and take notes about it. Listen to part of a discussion in an environmental science class.
The exploitation of minerals involves five steps. First, you have to explore and locate the mineral deposits. Then you set up a mining operation. Next, you must refine the raw minerals and transport the refined minerals to the manufacturer.
Excuse me, sorry. I only have four steps. Could you?
Sure. That's exploration, mining, refining, transportation, and manufacturing.
Thanks.
So, each of these activities involves costs. There are costs associated with them, and the costs can be economic, but not necessarily so. Mineral exploitation also has environmental costs associated with it. For example, the exploration stage will clearly have a high economic cost because of personnel and technology, but the environmental cost will probably be quite low. Why would that be, do you think?
Because you aren't actually disturbing the environment. You're just looking, I mean, after you find a mineral deposit. You don't do anything about it at that stage.
Right. So, the environmental costs would be low. But what happens when you use up all the resources that are easy to find? Then what?
Then the costs go up for exploration.
Which costs?
Well, probably both of them. But I can see where the economic costs would increase.
Okay. Let's say, for example, that some areas such as national parks or historic reserves have been off-limits to exploration. What will happen when we use up the minerals outside of these areas? Remember now that these are non-renewable resources that we're looking for.
Then there will be a lot of pressure, you know, to open up these areas to exploration and exploitation.
Probably so. And that means that there could be a high environmental cost. Any other options?
Find an alternative.
Yes, you're on the right track.
Okay, find an alternative. I mean, a substitute. Something that will substitute for the mineral. Maybe something man-made?
Good. That will involve a different kind of exploration. Again, with economic costs. I'm talking about basic research here to find synthetics. But, let's go on to the other steps, and we'll see if we can pull this all together. How about mining? Now, we're looking at high environmental costs because of the destruction of the landscape and the accumulation of waste products that have to be dealt with. Air and water pollution is almost always a problem. Any ideas on refining?
Wouldn't it be the same as mining? I mean, you would have high costs because of labor and equipment. And there would be problems of waste and pollution, like you said.
True, true. And in refining, well, that often involves the separation of a small amount of a valuable mineral from a large amount of surrounding rock. So that means that refining also carries the additional cost of cleanup. And don't forget that it's often difficult to get vegetation to grow on piles of waste. In fact, some of it, the waste piles, I mean, they can even be dangerous to living creatures, including people, not to mention the appearance of the area. So the environmental costs can be extremely high. Isn't it sad and ironic that so much of the mining and refining must take place in areas of great natural beauty?
So you're saying that both mining and refining have heavy costs, heavy economic and environmental costs.
Right. And in both mining and refining, you would need transportation to support the movement of supplies, equipment, and personnel. But after the minerals are mined and refined, then transportation becomes even more essential.
And I was just thinking that in addition to the economic costs of the transportation for trucks and fuel and labor and everything, there might be some construction, too, if there aren't any roads in and out of the area.
And that would mean?
That would mean that the landscape and even the ecosystem for the plants and animal life could be altered. So that's an environmental cost.
It is indeed. Good point. That leaves us with manufacturing. After we find it, mine it, refine it, and transport it, we still have to manufacture it. What are the costs associated with that? Well, construction again for factories. Then there would be energy costs, technology, and labor.
So all that's economic. No environmental costs in manufacturing then.
Well, yes, there are actually. Pollution is often a costly problem for manufacturing plants.
Oh, right. I was thinking of the natural landscape, and the manufacturing is often positioned near cities to take advantage of the labor pool. But cities have the environmental problems associated with pollution. So every step has both economic and environmental costs then.
Right.
26. What is the main topic of this lecture? According to the professor, what are two problems that can be anticipated when roads are cut into an area for mining? Listen again to part of the lecture, then answer the question.
And I was just thinking that in addition to the economic costs of the transportation for trucks and fuel and labor and everything, there might be some construction too if there aren't any roads in and out of the area.
And that would mean?
Why does the professor say this?
And that would mean?
29. What option is proposed as an alternative when all of the mineral resources in easily accessible locations have been depleted? 30. What does the professor imply about the environmental costs of mineral exploitation?